Hey, good afternoon. So, last time we looked at two approaches to dealing with bounce checking that, were different than baggy bounce checking, but were more practical in the sense that you can actually like easily download an implementation of them. So one was Address Sanitizer, which was this compiler-based approach, and another was Valgrind Memcheck, which was this virtual machine-based approach. So Address Sanitizer work with C and C++ code, Valgrind Memcheck work with machine code. But in both cases, their strategy was based on allocating red zones between objects, red zones being deliberately unusable space. In the case of Valgrind Memcheck, this was only for the heap. In the case of Address Sanitizer, because they were in the compiler, they could do this for things on the stack, because they could change the stack allocation code to allocate some extra space for this unused stuff. And there would be a lookup table, which would say whether each location was valid. And if you tried to access something in the middle of a red zone, you could look at the lookup table and say, oh, that's a bad place. And Address Sanitizer and Memcheck would instrument all memory reads and writes to add a check for this lookup table. And this was different than baggy bounce checking because they wouldn't check like why we got to that memory location. They just say, once we got a memory location, is it okay or is it not? So some questions about this. So one question is, when we talk about red zones, I showed examples where we were allocating a lot more than just one byte. Wouldn't one byte be enough? And there are kind of two issues with just allocating one byte. So one issue has to do with something called alignment. And if you've taken 30 through 30, you might recall that processor caches sort of work in these big blocks. And if you haven't, well, processor caches work in blocks, which are, typically something like 64 bytes long. And this is sort of cached in the processor. And when we do an instruction like a move, BX, it would be really nice if we could satisfy this instruction by taking part of this block and sending it into the register rather than the bad case of needing to take a little bit of this block and also a bit of another block. And if you have to do this sort of thing where we combine two different blocks, you take two different pieces of two different blocks and combine them together, this ends up being way slower. So for that reason, we want to allocate extra space between objects so the objects are at multiples of an address where we don't have this problem. Another issue that's sort of going to make us want to make these red zones big is that we can kind of accidentally skip over a small red zone with some types of array. So let's say I have an array of, say, these structs here. So a struct with an int a and an int b. And let's say my out of bounds struct foo, and I have an array of them. So struct foo array, say of 100 of them, and let's say I do array 100 dot b. Well, this is going to be 4 bytes after the end of the array, not one. So if we only allocated 1 byte for the red zone, that wouldn't be enough, and we might want to try to be generous because things like this kind of end up happening naturally. And another sort of case that might happen is even if we're, accessing something at the beginning, if the out of bounds, is by 2 instead of 1, we all might also want to handle that case. Because, those sort of little off by 1 errors are things we're concerned about. So another question is, how can Valgrind prevent problems without modifying the program itself? And so Valgrind Memcheck is, I would treat it, this is kind of basically it's a sort of an emulator slash virtual machine. And it's true that we kind of like gave this as magic. And you might say, how would you make that work? And basically what Valgrind Memcheck does is it takes snippets of machine code and converts them to other machine code. It's a machine code to machine code compiler. And in this, you know, machine code to machine code compiling, it can add these lookup table checks. Okay, I guess the other half of the question is, wouldn't the program not be run in Valgrind if it was being exploited by the attacker? So we could run our production programs in Address Sanitizer or Valgrind Memcheck. Like, these are things where the program runs normally. So this is hypothetically, if we were really concerned about memory errors, we could, like, run our web server this way. And the reason you don't see people doing this, you know, well, one of them is that we mentioned that it doesn't prevent certain types of exploits from working, so it might not be effective enough to be worthwhile. But another reason is that it's just a lot slower. But you can still do it, and if you were doing that, it would make it so you couldn't exploit it while running in there. And then a question, for question three, wouldn't the actual code on the quiz, wouldn't the actual code not run? So I believe I was careful on that quiz question to use the phrase that the actual code run to execute the line. And the actual code run to execute the line is going to be, well, it turns out this sort of translated machine code, or if you thought it was like an emulator approach, it would be the code in Valgrind that is doing like reading an instruction and figuring out what to do if we had an emulator-like approach. My intention was that that was, you know, what actually happened on the machine, not sort of the program code that ran. But I understand that it was hard to figure out how to phrase that clearly without kind of giving away how Valgrind works. So other questions about Address Sanitizer or Valgrind Memcheck? Okay. So another thing that came up was we were looking at random testing and mentioned that this is sort of a very simple way, which is reasonably effective at finding memory errors. And well, random can mean a lot of things. Like, we have to figure out what sort of distribution we're drawing from. And sort of one idea is that we can like start with an input that works and sort of mutate it in random ways. And another idea is that we can like make a custom generator for sort of a particular format. So like we saw the example of testing C compilers, we can write a program that generates C programs that where we know, oh, C programs have variable declarations. Let's write a function that chooses a random type and a random variable name, you know, and they have statements. Let's have a function which chooses a random type of statement, a random operator, and we can generate things in that way that are random inputs. And this is a reasonable way of finding things like memory errors, because all we need to know if there's sort of a memory bug is, does something like a seg fault or a failure of one of these lookup table checks happen? And then we know there's a memory error, and that's useful for us from a security perspective, because a lot of these memory errors are going to be security problems. So this kind of gives us a list of things we should fix that an attacker might exploit. And we said, well, random testing is nice, but it would be nice to be more systematic. And when we looked at sort of how we tested manually, kind of a common approach is we like look at the code and we figure out, how do I test this part of the code? How do I test this part of the code? And we can automate that. And we saw this with this idea of symbolic execution, that we'd, you know, kind of run the program, but instead of having normal values, we kind of treat them as algebraic variables. And we just solve equations that resulted from whatever values we computed with those algebraic variables. So like if we had an if statement that if x is greater than y, we'd kind of say, okay, to figure out what input I need to do this, I'm going to figure out, you know, some input where x is greater than y. And if we had other constraints, you know,
hello,
where x is less than 2 times y, we'd do something like, you know, we could solve for possible values of x and y sort of algebraically. And this approach, you know, let us sort of systematically, you know, explore every path through the program. And it's a very, you know, valuable approach, but there's going to be some big practical issues. Like, you know, if you had the time to do this, well, you know, you get a complete test of the program. You could, like, basically, you could actually prove that it doesn't have any memory errors. The problem is, well, there's going to be too many paths, like possibly literally an infinite number of sort of paths through the program. And solving equations, you know, it's kind of hard to like solve an algebraic equation that's underspecified in 3 or 4 variables by hand. And well, computers are better at it. They're not that much better at it. So, you know, this is something we can do, but it's not something that, you know, is going to be practical on a large program. Or even on a small program, when we do it, we're not going to find all the things to test. We're just going to find a lot of them. So questions about symbolic execution or random testing before we sort of finish up talking about symbolic execution today? Or other follow-up questions on things? Okay. So to think about symbolic execution, let's do this exercise. So let's say that I'm going to represent these as big X and big Y, which I'll write with bars to emphasize that they're big. These inputs, you know, if we want to, like, if our symbolic execution is solving an equation to figure out if this assertion fails, you know, what equation should it be solving? Okay. So, most of you, so the plurality answer is the one which has, starts with x less than or equal to y, and we have this other condition. So, and then we have sort of a split between that and something else. So I think, something else is the better answer. So the way I go through this is I just try to do this step by step. So initially, our x is this bar x, this big x, and our y is this big y. And then we get past here. And if we got past this return, then I know that this statement was false. So big X was less than or equal to big Y. And that's going to be a condition that carries as we keep going down. So we're going to just track that. Big X is less than big Y, less than or equal to big Y, had to be true. And that's probably the big thing you said to say, well, none of the other ends, only something else or X less than or equal to Y are possible. You can eliminate the other answers because of that. And yeah, it's a bit tricky that you need to reverse this because if this is true, we don't do the things below. So then we get to this assignment here. And instead of X being big X, now X is big X plus big Y. Where big Y was the current value of big Y. And that's going to hold true. And then we have this assertion and we want to know when this is false. So it's X here is going to be big X plus big Y, and Y is big Y at this point, plus 1, and Y is again big Y. So it's big X plus big Y plus big Y plus 1 has to be greater than or equal to Y. And the option that wasn't something else has one of these plus signs turned into a minus sign. So something else, I believe, was the best answer. And as for, yeah, so, and we could have simplified this. So this is also big X plus 2 big Y plus 1 is greater than or equal to big Y. So question is, what's an input? So there is an input which makes this fail. And this is something which makes writing these symbolic execution tools surprisingly tricky, is that you have to actually deal with things on this sort of basis, is that the problem is there's an integer overflow. So what's a way of triggering that integer overflow? And this tells us that when we're doing symbolic execution, those equation solvers, they're not solving kind of normal equations. They're solving these sort of equations on the types of variables we have in our program. And we need to write equation solvers that actually handle that sort of issue. Okay. So a majority of you want Y to be U and max. I like this idea, except that it's hard to make I like that idea. So Y is U and max, then this is always going to be false because x is not going to be greater than y, and we're going to overflow into x, and whatever value this is, as long as it isn't u at max, this assertion will fail. Or, oh, y being u at max, sorry, that will not make this assertion fail, though, because this will be u at max. So it causes overflow, but it doesn't make the assertion fail. Oh, it makes it... Oh, did I invert this assertion? No. Right. It doesn't make this fail, but it makes it true. Which I guess is probably what I meant to do. Yeah. So it makes this assertion true, which is what I think what you were going for, but I probably should have inverted the question. Because it kind of doesn't make sense to assert this as something we expect to be typical. Because typically we expect x plus y to be greater than y, not less than y. But this would be our exception case. So sorry about probably confusing questions on what's going on here. So y equals u int max means that x plus y plus 1 would be less than y is true, and sort of more typical values of x, y would mean that it's false. So the sort of first option would mean it's false, and I probably should have been more clear on the direction I was going for with this question. But you have get the idea about sort of reasoning about overflow. So failing the assertion usually means that the assertion is false, which is why this is probably the answer that the question as written was going for. But that's not the hint I gave, because I was inconsistent. So I should have said passes. This is the question I should have asked. To be consistent with my hint. Sort of. The big picture thing is that, sort of, we want to construct this sort of equation here, and when we're solving it, we have to, like, think about integer overflow as affecting our solution set. And I will remember to try to correct these slides afterwards. So, that's sort of an example of sort of symbolic execution. We have to do this equation solving. And it's not actually possible to do the solving in general. Like, it's NP hard. So if you've taken 3501, 3201, theory of computation, you know that means basically we probably can't actually do it. But there are solvers which are good enough if your programs are small enough and you have a bunch of additional heuristics. And because these solvers arise, that's why this technique became popular. So it's typically used more in the research domain, but these tools are practical. So they're practical tools you can download and which will generate test cases for you. And they've gone through a lot of work to make that possible. And a big part of it is that people who work on equation solving, sort of in the theory across with AI domain, have gained a whole lot of progress in the past several decades. Since the 1970s, when someone proposed symbolic execution, but you couldn't actually do it because it was just way, way too slow. But they still need to do a lot of work to make this work okay. So one thing, for example, CLI, which was one of the first sort of more practical versions of these symbolic execution tools, did is that it has a lot of work on sort of heuristics, that's your guesses, to get good results. And one thing they need to do is they kind of prioritize paths. So they don't find all the paths in the program. They don't make a complete set of test cases. They just try to do a good set, and they sort of have these heuristics on where are good parts of the code to try to solve equations to make new inputs. They also do a lot of work to call their equation solver less and to make its input simpler, to identify variables they can eliminate in advance, to cache cases where you can't go down this path, you know, prove because of the constraints you already have. And they achieved, you know, pretty good results, and this was in 2008, so you can probably do a lot better today. You know, they can get, like, they got better coverage in terms of if you measured lines of code executed than sort of developer-written tests for some projects, which is pretty impressive. Now, this symbolic execution idea sort of involves a lot of this tricky equation solving, and there's something where we can take advantage of one of these ideas, but do something a lot more simple and practical. And sort of the big idea that we had to do symbolic execution is that we were thinking, oh, a good way of testing is maximizing the paths run. And it's hard to do this by actually solving how do I get down this path, but it's easy to measure when you've done that. It's easy to measure which paths you're actually using. And so another more popular idea is let's just do that measurement and use this to sort of guide our random testing. So let's do random testing, but bias it towards these extra paths. So let's try to maximize the paths by just making guesses and seeing how they explore down the paths. And so a way we might do this is let's say here's the code we want to test, and I'm going to mark the different sort of pieces of code we can run with these sort of labels W, X, Y, Q, and Z. And I'm going to start with some test case, and I can say this test case where I provide A of 0x17 and B of 0x0b, you know, it's going to cover W and Z. We're going to go into here, and we're going to go into here. And my goal is to find a new test case that covers something we haven't seen yet. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm just going to make a random change to this test case. So I'll just randomly start with this test case and manipulate part of it and see what happens. And I just keep doing this until something interesting happens. And where something interesting here is that, oh, I manipulated this B and I randomly chose 0. And now I'm covering this new space. So this is just our random testing process, but as we're doing the random testing, we're seeing, did we succeed in covering some code that previously we didn't? And now I have two test cases. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to continue generating random tests by manipulating my prior test cases, but instead of just starting with this test case A, I'm going to start with both of these tests. And I'm going to make random changes. And by doing that, I can kind of make my way down to here, down to Q here, you know, and also eventually find, you know, how to get to X, incidentally. And when I'm making my way down to Q, well, I'm doing it by starting with, you know, this test case B that made it to Y. And this sort of exploration, that's, it's going to like sort of make its way further and further down the path because we're starting with something which gets closer to our goal, which is to eventually run all these lines of code. You know, to get run Q, we need to run Y. You know, so it's better to start with something which already runs Y. And we can kind of do this systematically. And this will, you know, let us actually run the whole program. Questions about sort of the rationale behind this process? And so we can also, like when we're looking at this idea, so here I showed us as, oh, we're trying to cover things we haven't covered before. But also for testing, something we want to do is we kind of want to get tests with unique list of things covered too. So here, you know, same idea. We start with this test which covers W and Z. We manipulate it until we randomly cover X and Y. But we're not going to consider ourselves done then, because if we're considering all paths, well, we want the path that include goes W to Y to Z without doing X. But this process will let us find that because, you know, we'll start with this test that's closer to the one that omits X, you know, and eventually we'll get to that test which just does W and Y. And similarly, you know, if we randomly start from these tests, we'll eventually randomly choose A to be 0, and we'll get to something which covers another path of just, say, Y, or another path of just, say, Z. So we're going to do this not to just, you know, cover more examples, but to, you know, cover more of the code, but also to cover more distinct paths, because maybe there's a bug that only happens when we don't execute this X statement, for example, in sort of a real version of this code. Okay, so I don't have a quiz question, a question for this, but I can probably fix that. So, we'll go with the, so question here is we're looking at these examples, you know, which is, would we benefit most from using coverage guided fuzzing? I guess so. I have A, B, and C on the quiz, but I mean A, B, C. Which one would coverage guided fuzzing help us the most or the least over sort of using our just a pure random testing approach? Because, you know, coverage guided fuzzing, like if generating random tests would, you know, do as well, it's going to be slower because we have to measure what code actually runs. So we have a pretty good consensus that A is the best. And the way I think about this, if we think of what the sort of assembly for this would look like, or if we're like measuring coverage, we can kind of measure each of these if statements separately. Because if you, if you remember how sort of how, well, if you think of how this compiles, like we're going to do a compare of 4 and the register containing A, and then if that is, you know, if that is greater than, we're going to go somewhere else, and then we're going to do a compare of 4 and the register containing B, and if that is greater than, we're going to go somewhere else. And when we're measuring coverage, typically what a coverage guided tool will do is it's going to measure each of these sort of instructions, or usually it's going to measure, you know, everything up to a jump as a separate thing covered. So this will be sort of a, you know, W and an X would be in a Y. So we'd end up sort of having this evolution where when we had a random test that passed this first part of the if statement, we'd realize from our coverage guided tool, oh, that was covering something. And if we got, you know, covering something more than the previous test, so we kind of evolve a value that, you know, gets closer and closer to satisfying each part of this if statement, going from left to right, because that's the order the compiler in C would have to do these checks. Or most likely would do these checks, I should say. It doesn't have to. So I think A is indeed probably the best for sort of a coverage-guided approach. Because we can kind of make random guesses and get a little bit further. And if we were doing a pure random approach, well, we would kind of not know when we're making progress. We just say yes or no, and that wouldn't be helpful. As for the worst for coverage guided, I think, you know, so that would be, I think, B. And B and C both seem very problematic in that we have to guess this very, you know, this very odd looking number. Like, so they're going to take a long time to make a good test case, the test case that makes it fail with either approach. But coverage-guided fuzzing, at least, if we think about how this compiles, we're going to have a compare of 10.5 followed by a conditional jump, you know, and then a compare of 10.43. And when we're checking what code gets run at the assembly level, we'll say, oh, you know, did we run this or not? And that will let the coverage-guided approach make progress, you know, a bit better than just making random guesses for A and B. It was going to figure out that its guess for A is right and be able to, like, produce random test cases starting with that correct guess, which the sort of random, pure random approach won't be able to do. But we don't have any of that sort of help on example two. So question on my reasoning for here, which is that, say that this is probably best, you know, better, most better, and least better. So the question is, on this example, you know, wouldn't only, so on these, wouldn't, if this statement isn't true, wouldn't only the first piece of assembly code run? So, yeah, if we start with this check, then our coverage check, sort of our list of what is covered, let's say we, like, mark this as W, then X, then Y, we'd say, oh, only W is covered when A is not 10.325. Only this compare runs. But when we randomly guess the value of A that was right, we'd realize in the coverage-guided approach, oh, X is also running, sorry, Y is also running now, too. So there are a bunch of these random testing tools that are coverage guided. And one example that I expect to use for our upcoming assignment is something, one called American Fuzzy Lop, named after the breed of rabbit, which uses this strategy. And basically what it does is it records the coverage information by modifying the assembly code. So it looks in the assembly code for jumps that are conditional or computed, and before them, it adds code which does add something to a hash table. So there's this big array that's basically a hash table, and it hashes the, you know, the source and destination address of the jump together and increments a counter. And the idea is that we can look at this array afterwards, and that's what's covered by the test case. And if we find a test case gives a new distinct value for this array, we say that it's one we want to base new test on. If we don't, then it's not what we want to base test on. And in addition to this, you know, finding more ways of executing more of the code, this also gives us the ability to easily sort of limit our test cases to just interesting ones. And one thing American Fuzzy Lop does is it outputs just unique test cases. So it looks for a test case which has a particular set of value for the coverage array after it executes and says, I'm only giving you one of these. There might be like 100 of them which give the same values. We're just going to give you one. And this sort of lets you easily, you know, get a something you can, you know, compactly, you know, test later. And also, this is sort of what it wants to do internally for finding things to base new test cases off of. Now, so far, I've kind of talked about doing random testing. And tools like AFL, American Fuzzy Lop, do some non-random testing, you know, that works really well in this coverage-guided approach. So, for example, you know, it will do some sort of systematic changes. So I sort of showed doing random changes, but it will do something like, let's flip every single bit and try all of those, because that each bit might be important, or let's set everything bit byte to zero and see what happens. So it just does a bunch of these sort of deterministic things that it's guessing are likely to, you know, change what branches happen. And, you know, this is useful to do because it knows it's starting with, you know, some part of the code we haven't executed before, and it can see how it's affected by just systematically changing, and it can find out, well, you know, did setting this byte to zero get us to a new path? And if so, you know, we'll take advantage of that right away, unlike random testing where we could do these systematic approaches and probably would, but we wouldn't know without that sort of feedback whether it actually helped anything. Okay. Now, another thing we can do when we have this coverage metric that's useful for sort of actually using these tools in practice is we can simplify the test cases. That you can systematically try changing the test case and see when you, how much you can change until you can get a test which covers the same thing. So an example of like what that might look like is, say, for example, here we have this test case here that covers Y and Z. But it's kind of not the simplest possible test case. You might say, is this 17.17 important? Is this 8 important? So something we could systematically do is we could try saying, let's try making a 0, a 1, and so on, and see what's the lowest value of A we can have that covers the same stuff. And we can do the same with B. And in that case, we get sort of this simpler version, where we'd say, oh, A, 1 is the lowest value of A, and 6 is the lowest value of B. And we have this sort of canonical simplified version where it would be more obvious to us as a human, you know, what's going on. And tools like AFL do this automatically for test cases. They'll take the input, they'll try, you know, removing every character, they'll try decrementing every byte down to zero until it executes something different, and they'll look for, you know, the simplest or the most canonical version that ends up covering the same code. And in particular, this is actually really important for the performance of these techniques, because often, sort of the techniques you'd have to like randomly mutate tests end up making your test really long, and that runs slow. So you want to shorten them, and this incidentally does that. But it also makes it more useful to someone reading the test cases. Like if you say this test crashes, you'd like it to be sort of the simplest version that crashes, not, you know, not something crazy weird that where you have to do a bunch of debugging work to figure out that, you know, most of the input isn't, it's just random numbers that aren't relevant. So questions about this idea of simplifying tests automatically?
I don't know how to phrase this, but doesn't this sort of assume that there's one space, one bound or one range that is correct and everything outside of that fails because it goes until it reaches a failure and then just sort of assumes everything beyond that is a failure?
So are you saying couldn't this miss, couldn't, because we're kind of assuming, yeah, things are, there's a contiguous range of things that go down this path, couldn't we miss, you know, some simpler way of getting down to the same coverage? Absolutely. So this is not necessarily making the simplest possible version, but it's the simplest under some assumptions. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, also if there's just a non-contiguous range of values that would lead you down that one path.
Yeah, so for example, like this decrementing every byte, like if you're doing X mod 2 equals 0, it's not going to do that. Not exactly. Going to handle it. And they might have, they have a bunch of, so AFL and other testers like this have a bunch of heuristics, but they're guesses, yes, and they're not going to always actually find the simplest way, but they work very often to make the test a lot easier for humans to deal with. Yeah, and I guess for probably one of the simplifications that might work for, say, this example is that if you, like, try flipping, if you try, like, zeroing every bit that's one, you know, that might be something you would try. But yeah, there's a sort of compromise here where we're kind of, these are all heuristics. And most of what the tool is doing, besides measuring what runs, is sort of guesses, but guesses that work very often and make it useful. So another thing about generating test cases is that we have these sort of generic strategies like flipping bits, combining existing inputs in some way. There's some other interesting things we can do. Given that we know, you know, more information about a program. So one thing that AFL does that's interesting is that this strategy of duplicating important looking keywords. And you might say, how would AFL know that there's a keyword? And a way we can kind of know that is that if we have a range of bytes where changing any of them causes it, the program to go down a different path, you can kind of actually tell that they're a keyword and know to copy that. And so AFL finds sort of keywords, like if you're running this on like a database, it will probably figure out that, oh, select is something that needs to be kept together, because it will notice that when it changes any of the characters in that thing, it goes down a different path. But if it didn't detect that, and often just to speed it up, it also supports sort of something that's akin to the, you know, generated testing program. You know, some compromise there is that it supports a dictionary. You can say, here's a list of things to try inserting in tests. So for example, if you're testing an HTML parser, you might have a list of all HTML tags. So, you know, so we'll try, you know, adding the HTML tag to every test at some random times, test more stuff. It also supports some other things for kind of fixing up tests. So one example is that you can supply your own sort of templates. Another is that you can do post-processing. So a common problem with random testing for things like file formats is that file formats often have things like checksums. So like if we have an image format with a checksum that verifies whether the image has been manipulated, well, if we randomly change the image, we're going to break the checksum. And if we don't do anything, all we're going to be testing is the checksum checking code. Because, you know, almost all the time, the checksum's going to be wrong. So a common thing people will do when trying to test things like that is that they'll have something which takes the random test case that the fuzzer generates and corrects the checksum in it by recomputing it. Another thing you might do is you might modify the image library to not check checksums anymore, just so you can test the rest of it. So that's on fuzzing. So we can think of fuzzing as sort of a practical sort of compromise, this gray box fuzzing, this coverage guided fuzzing as sort of a practical compromise for what symbolic execution was trying to do very systematically. And sort of the practicality we're trying to solve is that, well, you know, we can't actually, you know, solve all the program paths. So this practical compromise is we make educated guesses, and, you know, that would get us to the right parts of the program. But there are other ideas which are also in between, and we're going to look at some of them, where we can do analysis of programs that doesn't arise to the sort of completeness of symbolic execution, where we're like actually solving, you know, how to get down a path, seeing if an assertion fails, you know, we're running the program. And isn't sort of as random as gray box fuzzing. We're going to do other analysis. And when we're thinking about analyzing programs this way, we want to think about sort of two properties of our analyses, whether it's sort of complete. Did I write this correctly? No, I didn't. And of course I inverted my slide. It's positive. So in that, yes, I'm sorry I inverted this. So if it says there's a way to, you know, that will know that, you know, if it says there's a way to reach assertion fail, we'll have an example. You know, if there is a way, you know, so if there is a way to reach an assertion, is a way, it will be found. And we don't want sort of false positives that if it's really there's no way to reach the assertion failure, you know, there should actually be no way. So that's what we mean by sort of a sound analysis. So complete means, you know, we actually explore all the possibilities, you know, and sound means that we don't sort of get compromises where we say, yeah, this could happen. You know, yeah, you're safe, and it's actually true. Or, you know, if we says there's a way to reach an assertion failure, there actually is a way. So complete is, you know, all paths sort of explore, all paths accounted for. And sound is that sort of we haven't sort of made these compromises where, you know, we have no, you know, sort of no impossible paths, you know, accounted for. And we'll see why, you know, we have impossible paths when we're talking about approximations. Because something we're going to do when we want to do better than symbolic execution or fuzzing is that, you know, we're not going to end up actually running the program, but we're going to do something which might be closer to complete, where we're going to, like, actually find, you know, a real example that's practical for a large program. And I'm sorry for messing that up. I will correct that after lecture. But sort of the design points we want are things where, you know, we're going to be able to explore more of the program, but we might compromise whether or not, we actually get all results which are, actually possible executions, because we're not really executing the program. And there's some other design points, where instead of like symbolic execution, we track all the values of variables, we can track sort of just properties of interest. And where instead of like actually computing precisely how to get to a path of code, we can use some approximation. So I'll give an example of this, thinking about how we can deal with use after free. And, I think of, if we were doing full execution, we want to track what's the value of a pointer. But we can, for use after free, we don't actually care about where the pointer points exactly, what's stored in memory there, which is all things we would track for symbolic execution. We just care, is it allocated or free? And a simplification we can make is, like, rather than figuring out if if statements can happen, let's just assume that if we have if x, y, lc, that both y and z are possible. So a way we can sort of apply this model is we can go down, here I'm going to start with an example with no if statements, is that we can say, okay, at A, here, we have quux is in the state allocated. Then when B, we see that we executed this free, so it's in the state freed. And in C, we see it's being used, so we can call this a use after free error. And this is very similar idea. We're tracing through the code like we did with symbolic execution, but rather than tracking what quux points to and what the value that is, and we're just tracking, is it allocated or freed? And this is a lot simpler. And we're kind of ignoring this code in between, which is going to make this a lot more practical. So we can give a warning in this case. Now, this could be a false positive. So why could this be a false positive? So why could we have said this is a use after free bug, but it's not actually a use after free bug? So there's some approximation we're making here. That means that we're not precise. So you're saying a new pointer at the same address. So that's a good idea, is that, maybe we have, let's assume there's no assignments use of quux here. And new pointer at the same address. Let's assume that if we have a use after free issue, that we consider that still a use after free bug if there's another malloc that uses the same address. So there's another sort of more fundamental problem, that something we're not accounting for. Now, it's something which seems silly, but that we're not accounting for. Yeah, someone was speaking.
Is it possible that just the conditionals in the code that we omitted just like make it so that C doesn't get reached?
The option is that maybe C doesn't get reached. So how could that happen? Let's say we have an infinite loop here. Maybe there's no way of actually reaching C. So this is not precise, and with symbolic execution, we realize, we can't actually get to here, but this analysis, we're taking a shortcut. We're saying, that code isn't relevant because it doesn't deal with quux, even though it can affect whether this bug exists or not. And this is probably a shortcut we're very comfortable taking, but it is imprecise. This is technically unsound, because this might not be a real bug. Now, there are tools which do this analysis. So one example is Clang has a tool called ScanBuild, which is part of the Clang analyzer. And I ran it on a very similar function, and this is the report it shows me. It says, here's a use of memory after it's freed, where in this function, memory is allocated here, it's freed here, and then it's used here. And notice that it did this even though it didn't even have the code for this something unknown function. It's just saying, Don't know what that function does, but it doesn't look at it. So it's making the same approximation. So the question is, what if free is indirectly called? So that would ideally be something it would figure out, right? So in this case, it can probably guess that free isn't called by something unknown because quux isn't passed to something unknown. But let's say we had, free, we had a call to, foo of quux and foo called free. We had some indirect call to free. In this case, the analysis would need to look into that function call or be imprecise. And in the case of Clang Analyzer, they've decided they're doing a function at a time, so if you do this, they're going to be wrong. And the reason they're doing that is that makes the performance of their analysis more practical. But the disadvantage is it gives the wrong answer sometimes. Other questions? Okay, so this was a simple case. So let's have a more interesting case here. So here, I allocate quux, and I have this if statement where I have this conditional that, is hard to analyze. And if we were doing symbolic execution, we'd kind of like solve to see what happens here. But we're going to do some simpler approximation where we're just going to guess that, if there's an if statement, presumably both sides of the if statement happen. So there's multiple sort of paths we're going to have to consider. So one path is that we, go here, we free quux, and then we go to here. Okay, that's unproblematic. Now, that's one possible path. Another path is that we could go to C after B. Because remember, we're doing both sides of the if statement. So we have the kind of this fork. We go to C, in which case, quux is freed. So this is a use after free. And we have a third possible path, set of paths coming from A, where we go A skipping over B to C, or A directly to D, in which case quux is still allocated. And if we're doing this analysis, we kind of have options about how we report this. So probably it's actually, we can just say, okay, I've noticed that if we go from A to B to C, there's a bug. And we can say, this might be wrong, and here's how it happened. Another option is that we could do something like symbolic execution, but selectively. We could say, let's now do some hard work and figure out what this complex function does and see if this is actually possible. Now, Clang Analyzer that I just showed you takes the first approach. It just says, something's probably wrong. So it gives me this report. It says, you allocate memory here, and assuming this is true, you free it here, and then assuming this is true, you use it. So questions about sort of how we did this analysis? Okay, so you can see that we're making this graph. So let's look at this example. So here, I'm saying that we have A where P and Q are allocated. And then we go to A1, then B, then C, or we go directly to B, then C. And I'm asking, when we get to C, in either of these ways, what should our allocated or freed state be for Q? And this is going to reveal, you know, something that's really annoying about doing this kind of analysis. It makes it a lot harder for these analysis to be practical. Okay, so most of you have come up with the correct answer, which is that it's freed if we go via the A1 path and allocated otherwise. And the reason that happens is that, well, they're the same pointer if they go through the A1 path. But this means that, you know, what I was showing here wasn't tracking enough information. I was just tracking, is Quux allocated or freed? But, you know, and I showed here, I'm just tracking if P and Q are allocated, but I really need to track, oh, and P and Q point to different things. Things, and now I need to say, oh, P and Q point to the same thing. And P and Q point to different things still. I need to track that information in addition when I am exploring these paths. And that seems awfully annoying, and it's a big actual performance problem. Now, Plane Analyzer does this work. So it will give a warning in this case. It will say, oh, okay, you know, this is a potential use after free because we could make P equal Q, in which case we're freeing what Q points to afterwards. So it figures out that they're pointers to the same thing, but it meant that it's doing a bunch of work to actually keep track of whether P and Q point to the same thing. And this is a big problem in all sorts of analysis we might want to do of programs that we actually need to track this information. And it's also sort of the hidden component of symbolic execution that we need to know. Do these two pointers point to the same place? And that was annoying because, well, we don't want to actually execute the whole program. So how can we do this? And sort of the basic approach is that for every pointer, we're going to track sort of the set of things it can point to. So in this case, I'll say this malloc is ID 1, this malloc is ID 2, and I'm going to track what P and Q point to. I'm just going to say, drew that line wrong, that, you know, if we get to A, then, you know, they point to ID 1 and ID 2. When we get to B, they both definitely point to ID 2. And we can say if we get to this, you know, depending which path we get to, they either point to ID 1 or ID 2. So we can sort of track this information uh, less directly here. So questions about sort of what this tracking looks like. And note that for clarity, I've kind of defined whenever we have this sort of new version of a value, I sort of distinguish which version it is. And that's sort of something that it would be a common first step in program analysis is keeping track of different versions of values. So you might say, well, this seems awfully complicated here because if we have lots of paths through the program, we're tracking a lot of information. Now, a simplification might be that, you know, we have just kind of one value per path, but, you know, it's still a lot. So something we can do as an approximation is we can, you know, do a less precise analysis, something that will sometimes give the wrong answer, where we kind of say, oh, when we get to C, we're going to say there's a new version of P, and P is either one or two. Points to either one or two. It could be either of them. And this might be, you know, good enough. If it's not good enough, well, we're going to sometimes give you warnings when we shouldn't, but, you know, at least we're giving errors in the right direction. Now, this sort of, you know, these sort of issues of like figuring out whether two pointers point to the same place, you know, really makes, you know, limits sort of the usefulness of our analysis tools. But it's something that we deal with, and, you know, there's lots of things that are complicated here that you learn more about if you took a compiler's course. But sort of the high level idea is that, well, we can often do this with sort of two ideas, which is that, you know, we can make approximations when we don't want to compute the precise answer. That if we don't know what a pointer points to, we can make this sort of high, lots of false positives assumption that let's assume it points to anything of the right type. Or we can have a high false negative solution where, you know, if we don't know anything, let's just assume it doesn't point to anything important and hope that that doesn't make us miss something. And we might use either of these because typically when we have one of these analysis tools, sort of our goal is to detect a lot of errors, but not so many false positives that programmers get annoyed. You know, and so we might adjust which strategy we use, you know, in order to like achieve a good, you know, a reasonably good set of guesses or set of errors that are mostly right. Now, another thing which comes up in this sort of analysis is that we have things like loops. So here, there is a use after free bug that, you know, involves going through this loop, and we have to like do that. And we can basically treat the loop as kind of like an if statement that goes somewhere weird. So like enumerating my paths here, you know, we say, okay, in the case where we get to D, we can go back to the top here, you know, and, you know, ideally we'd avoid, you know, having an explosion of this tree here of, you know, possible of tracking our values by saying, oh, this state here, as far as what we're concerned about, is the same as when we started the loop. Because all we care about is what's allocated. Well, we can just reuse what we computed before. And we don't need to worry about like having a separate version of these nodes here for the second iteration of the loop. And if we do that sort of analysis, we can eventually you know, go through all our possibilities. So for example, here, I was missing what I had what happened if I went from D to E, but I was missing what happens if I went from D to B. So if I add that in, well, if I go from D to B, I can go to C, and I can find I have a double free book. And if I continue exploring my possibilities, I can see, okay, I'm at B here. I went from B to C, but I didn't go from B to D. Well, here we are, B to D. That's the same as this D because it was freed already. And so you can see in a loop, I can kind of get to this state where things aren't changing, and that's how I can deal with analyzing these loops without, you know, in most cases, worrying about sort of running out of space. And I guess I'm going to have to stop here because we're out of time. And you can see that this is something that Clang's Analyzer also does manage. So I'll take questions before I sign off. And I'll try to clean up slides. I know that's what I get for putting together slides late. But hopefully things were clear enough. It's harder to tell with the online environment.
Will we learn about exploits in languages other than C at any point in this course?
So not explicitly, but we're going to talk about these techniques here, these sort of program analysis techniques and testing techniques apply very well to languages that are not C.
Okay.
And the reason why we're learning about exploits, a lot of exploits in C, is that if we look at sort of like recent like exploit competitions, like over half the bugs that people have exploited are memory safety bugs. Even in hardened applications like virtual machines and web browsers.
Thank you.